fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it, come in no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven in the middle of it. Grass makes heaven in the middle. We are. Grass makes heaven in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We have a very special guest live from London, England. His name is Sammy Habib. Welcome to our program, Sammy Habib.
Welcome. Thank you, sir.
Well, I'll tell you what, tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and so forth, and then tell us what you're doing in London at this time also.
Well, I'm a Palestinian journalist. I used to work as a journalist in the Middle East and the Gaza Strip for various international outlets. At the moment, I'm in London. I'm pursuing my postgraduate PhD in media and media bias.
Right. How are your studies progressing? Are you learning a great deal and then exposing a lot of the students to some of your past experiences?
Well, certainly, yes. Looking at the theoretical literature of the media and comparing it to the practical performance of the media, certainly there are lots of things, really, in which media outlets are deceiving people, or like having some sort of flagrant bias in covering various issues.
Yes, that's right. And right now we have some very serious issues, not only the Palestinian question, but also the Syrian question. And what's going on from your viewpoint over there in Syria right now? What's your view? What kind of update could you give us on that?
Well, you know, like as any other Middle Eastern, like with the mainstream view on the Middle East, look, we want a change in Syria. We want a peaceful change in Syria. But we don't want Uncle Sam to come. We don't want the Yankees from the north to come, okay? We want the regime to change. Let the people have their own democracy. But why to have America? You know, there's a sensitivity within the entire Middle East. Like it or not, America is the traditional enemy of the Arabs, you know? This is a truth. This is a fact. So when America is saying, oh, they're going to strike Syria, like, I want the Assad regime to fall, but I don't want this to happen for America. And this is the case for all the Arabs, you know? We want to change all our dictator regimes because we know that, in a way or another, they are complicit. Okay, they have done very bad for their countries. They have not achieved democracy. They are really dictators. But we don't want America to come and to teach us democracy. American democratic style is clear, you know. Now, yeah. Obama is going even of going into a war without the consent of his parliament. But he's embarrassed because of what happened in London here. That's the reason he's going to the Congress to get a yes or no.
Right. The English people just don't want this, much less Parliament voted down the War Act, right, just recently.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the mainstream or the public here in England are so sensitive towards waging wars. You know, the war in Iraq still embedded in the people's mind, and they don't want to repeat it again because they think it will bring more about terrorism or whatever into the country. This is number one. Number two, they're not interested in following America, and this is the issue for most of Europe and England, you know. Always America is the top power that decides what the Europeans and the English have to do. And that's the case here in England. There are some rebellious members of parliament, some journalists and others who say clearly that we should not follow America on whatever they want. And I think the vote in the parliament was a setback, not only for David Cameron, who's in a way or another would follow with Obama, but it was a big setback for Obama. You know, the only and sole ally that always supported America is not in this war.
Right. The Russians, back in March, there was one chemical attack, and then recently, August 21st, there was another. What kind of information through the underground or just rumors do you have that who committed some of these chemical attacks?
Well, you know, it's not certain, really. Like, you know, there are lots of... Now, we have two competing views, you know, the Americans and the Russians. The Americans and the allies are saying the regime has, like, used these weapons and they've taken away chemical weapons, whatever. And the other part is the Russian part, which is having another account that the rebels have used it. And between these two, contradictory views, no one really could tell you exactly what happened. But, you know, we have to say some facts here, that the regime is the power in Syria that controls these places. They are the ones who really have these weapons. I don't think there would be any other party would have these weapons until maybe the account that the others are saying that maybe some countries have provided the rebels, which is not really a fact because, you know, these attacks happened within the areas that are under the control of the rebels. So there are two competing views. I don't want to stand by any of these views because it's not certain, and I cannot confirm it as many others.
Right. We have a view here within the alternative press about Benghazi. Perhaps some of those weapon systems could have been routed through Benghazi, through Lebanon, into the Syrian rebels. Do you have any kind of idea or facts about that?
No, I can't confirm this. I said there are two competing views, everyone is trying to, for the sake of true journalism, it's good for me and maybe for you and others just to wait and see. You know, I'm not going to follow America because Americans have, like, without having the results of the observers check on the ground, they have announced that they have proof of it, that the Syrian regime has used it. But I don't trust America, okay?
Right.
Okay, that's the reason you have to wait, really.
All right. Just recently, Russia has released a 100-page scientific study to the UN stating that the March attack, in their opinion, was promulgated by the rebels. And he's asking that for our government, the American government, to provide him and the American public and world at large the facts that we have about our evidence that the regime did the chemical attack. But that hasn't been forthcoming.
Well, that's the thing, you and I and the rest of the people would, like, contest the account of each other, but be clear, we have two accounts, contradictory accounts, the American and the Russian, and definitely each one would uphold their account and then try to support it with any, like, scientific or news or whatever reports they have, because at the end of the day, every party has its own benefit within the Middle East. The Americans, they wanted to attack Syria since long. They have, a plan for this decades and decades ago, and the American called for attack in Syria started back after in 2002 after the attacks in Afghanistan and after the attacks and the war in Iraq. You know, loudly the American started to say next is going to be Syria. And I think maybe this is the right time for the American to attack Syria, and that's the reason they're trying to seize any opportunity, okay, within the region to attack Syria. And this is as part of their plan. Later on, it might be Egypt and it might be Iran. You know, the Americans are coming strongly to the region. This is my own belief. And regrettably, you know, the Russians always approve the coup to be, you know, like most of us, as like people who do not like the Western hegemony or dominance within the region. We always wanted a superpower to compete America, like Russia, okay? But let's be frank about it. Russia is not the Soviet Union. Russia, okay, is too different. It's very different. You know, the Russians have sold Saddam Hussein twice. They sold the Libyan regime, and the idea, I think, to sell the Syrian regime, and that's easy for the Russians, you know. Back in the first Gulf War, they've taken billions out of the Saudi Arabia so they could stop supporting Saddam Hussein. We have not, let's be frank about it, we have not to rely much on Russia.
Right. The Saudis right now are taking a very aggressive stance. What do the Palestinians and Hamas, who are they supporting in this Syrian so-called civil war?
Well, look, the Palestinian opinion, I could clearly tell you, like, most of the Palestinians are not supporting Al-Assad, but in the same time, they are refusing totally, definitely, any American strike against Syria. Like, we have Hamas, like, we have issued a statement refusing the American, attack that will be coming soon. The Popular Front, the left, also refused it. Fatah also refused it. So the entire Palestinian faction, everyone in Palestine, they refused it. They don't want this. You know, we are looking for a national liberation. And in the same time, we cannot call the American invasion into Syria and welcome it. You know, it's contradictory and ironic, rather.
Right. What effect recently in the last few months has the Egyptian uproar and the removal of Morsi had on the relationships between Egypt and the Gaza?
Well, frankly, it's the Egypt-Palestine relation has been complicated since the time of Mubarak, you know?
Yeah.
Back in 2005 and 2006, when Hamas came to power, the relation deteriorated with the Egyptian regime because ideologically they are not okay with Hamas. Hamas is totally different to them. And from that time till Mubarak was abrogated in 2011, you know, the daily life in Gaza started to get bitter day after day. But later on, you know, when Morsi came, like, it was a bit bitter more and more, but as Morsi is done, we have the worst time for the Palestinians ever. Now, if you go to Gaza Strip now, there's no much fuel, there's no much power, there's no much food, and even this leadership, they have the military leadership in Egypt, they have closed all the tunnels, although these tunnels are used for the basics in Gaza.
Now, say that again about the tunnels now. Say that.
I said the Egyptians have closed most of the tunnels in Gaza. These tunnels are used by Palestinians to buy goods from Egypt and smuggle into Gaza.
Oh, I see. Because of the blockade, of the Israeli blockade. Has that been more strictly enforced lately or what?
Well, the siege is always, you know, and that's a fact. The Israeli siege in Gaza was not lifted.
Yeah, and over the years, the Israelis have really limited trade and exchange across those borders, have they not?
Well, there is some exchange of, like, we buy some goods from Israel, you know. But when the tunnels with Egypt were opened, we brought most of our needs from Egypt, as Israel is.
Okay, but right.
And out of Gaza.
Now, right now, the tunnels are closed, or what? What's the status of the tunnels?
Yeah, more than 95% of the tunnels have been closed by the Egyptian military. And Gaza, I'm telling you, it's boiling now. We are back like 2008, November 2008. So we are back in the old ages, you know, back to the medieval ages of siege, you know.
Oh, I see. I've got you. Now, I wrote a recent piece on Egypt, and in my research, I discovered that the armed forces or the military controls 20 to 35% of the Egyptian economy. Do you have any insights into that yourself?
Well, yes, that's a fact. You know, most of the factories in Egypt, the big factories, let's say the metal factory, the iron factories, the cement factories. Okay, it's owned by the army, for example. The highway construction company is owned by the army. And let's be clear about it. The army in Egypt, they have control in nearly most of the construction as well as the industrial sectors in Egypt. They have full control, and this is due to the reliance on the military over the past few decades. Egypt has been ruled by three military leaders like Abdel Nasser, Sadat, and Mubarak, who came from a background, a military background, and certainly they were affected. Even if you look now into Egypt after the recent coup against Morsi, now the military, yes, they have a bit this, let me call it a kangaroo government in the power, but at the same time, the military has its own people in most of the places, like the governors of each, like governorate or city, okay, they are appointed from a background, a military background, so they like generals, etc. They are running these cities. And I think the situation in Egypt is going to deteriorate more and more in the coming few weeks and months.
Right. The Morsi removal was in direct contradiction to the Constitution. So what I see is that the military, because they have such a large part of the economy, is that they're going to allow presidents to come in, but not to exercise power enough to remove their interests. Their interests are not going to be changed, I don't see. What do you think? What are your comments?
Well, you know, it's very complicated. It's not only the army. You know, the key powers that have contributed to the military coup is UAE, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. And those regimes, they do not want a Muslim Brotherhood regime within Egypt, because this means the government would be affected, and any time the Muslim Brotherhood could support any liberation movements within these countries. So this is the only and the first element beside the army. The army was supported by these countries and by other leftist and liberal Egypt, which is, I think, it's a setback for these liberal movements. You know, when you see all the leftists, the Marxists, Leninists, and others from the left, secularist, whatever, who supported this coup under the allegation that this is a religious government, I think it's a crap, you know? Elections there, but it was not respected by these parties and by the army. So there were many parties who did not want Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. I said it's Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Emirates, and Kuwait. Also, there's the military, also there's the secularist, liberal, and leftist parties in Egypt. So many different treaty parties did not want them. And all of them, they allied together, and they have removed the Muslim Brotherhood easily from power.
Right. The essence of what's going on looks like there's a balkanization process of the Arab countries based upon possibly the Bernard Lewis plan. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I do, but just before Bernard Lewis, I think it's maybe the new Middle East that Condoleezza Rice used to speak about back in the days, if you remember. You know,
this
is a new Middle East. It's being formed. You know, look, we as Arabs, we are sick of our dictators. We are sick of our regimes. We want to change them. Okay. There's a genuine move within people, whether in Syria, whether in the Gulf, whether in the North and in North Africa, whatever. There is a genuine movement from the people. But always, this genuine movement is being hijacked from the West. The problem with the West is they're trying to teach us what is democracy. They're trying to tell us what is democracy. And at the same time, they're not democratic within their own countries.
Right. I mean, yeah, look, our country's changed a great deal over the last several decades, that's for sure. So, we're hypocrites at times, because our leadership, the people that dominate this country, the international financiers and so forth, they want war, you know, and they'll make money out of it, see? And so the American public does not agree with that totally, even though the American public has been taken in by patriotism, see? And they've been beguiled and seduced by these very big powers that dominate our country to go to these wars. And this Iraq war was based upon false information, weapons of mass destruction, and all that. Those, of course, it's widely accepted now. Those were lies, you know, that were used to get us involved. We should have never been in Iraq.
I said, you know, it's clear, you know, the Americans, like, they have planned, as I read, you know, the conservative America back in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
So what is happening now? They have, you know, Henry Kissinger was not just a real, like, a normal man. He's the cunning of American foreign policy. I mean, many times, ruled over invading the Middle East on other soft ways, not only wars, there are other ways in which the Americans are really dominating the Middle East. Just go to the Gulf, go to Mecca, you know, the stronghold of the Muslims, and see how America is controlling the city there for McDonald's, KFC, and its franchise businesses. You know, it's not only just coming through wars. You know, they have other, like, colonialism aspects, like the industry and the economy that is being now extended across the Middle East.
Right. Where do you see the Libyan situation going? It seemed to be just breaking up. There's no centralized government that's been able to get it together, and these factions, these tribal factions and so forth. Is Libya going to ever get a government together to go back to and unify the country or not? What do you think?
Well, I do think so. You know, it's not clear in Libya. You know, it needs some more time to look, you know. And even there are some indications that the followers of Muammar al-Gaddafi are getting stronger and stronger, and time they might come back to Libya. And we've seen maybe a similar move in Egypt. You know, now the military coup has brought back all the bad people of the Mubarak government back to power, you know. I think
there are similar
things may be happening in Libya, you know, by time, you know. Gaddafi was not a saint at the end of the day, and he did terrible things for his people, and you might have his people back in power.
Well, you know, in this country, we have what we call a separation of church and state. In the Arab countries that where they're strongly Islam dominated religious wise, will they be able to create something that has a separation of church and state? Because doesn't it have a propensity to become the state also?
Well, the thing is, let's be practical about this.
Okay.
There is no control or a religious control within the Middle East, but we cannot ask for a separation. There is not, you know, like, when we look at Jordan, for example, who's governing Jordan? There's not military power. Most of these other countries are not ruled by any religious regime. That is, we cannot call for a separation because there is no regimes, really, or religious regimes there.
Right. Do you see then, like, Turkey being a model for the rest of the Arab countries?
Turkey really is the nice model. You know, you know what the Turks have managed to do is really great. You know, the government is allied with the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a Muslim Brotherhood at the end of the day. They have really, like, created a new model, which is a modern way of governing. It's a Muslim way, but in the same time, they are leaving the liberties for the people. You know, there's adultery in Turkey, there's drinking in Turkey, you know, and it's all allowed, you know. They did not came and cancel all these things, and this tells us that Muslim governments could cope and live. And this, I think, was about to happen in Egypt on Moses' time, because he did not, like, close such places or did limit the freedom of the people, but he was not given the chance at all. He was just a military coup, you know, like a storm of his power very quickly.
Yeah, Morsi in November started issuing some decrees. What was that a big mistake? It seemed like it was.
Well, yeah, it was this decree, but after a week, as I remember, he retreated and canceled what she called. And he really did not, you know, because maybe you're not following closely, you're following the media. The current president in Egypt, he issued more decrees than Morsi, and more dictator decrees than Morsi, and no one speaks about it. He issued more, like, decisions that are more dictator than any other president, and no one speaks about it, you know. All the powers of the parties in Egypt, the elite, the leftist, the liberal, they wanted the change in Egypt, but the grassroots people, the poor people who voted for Morsi, the amount of millions, are really more than those who went in the protest on the 30th of June, you know. They do not have a heard voice there, you know. Clearly, the election back in 2011 and 2012 made it clear that the Muslim Brotherhood and the Muslim parties have won with a landslide majority, which indicated that there is a trend, okay, that the people in Egypt wanted an Islamic government, like it or not, that's a fact. But I think Arabs need some more years to learn what is democracy.
Do you think that as far as part of the uprisings and the trouble you see in the Middle East has been a grassroots uprising and to fight for more democratic governments to throw off these dictators. Is that what you're saying here?
Well, I think, you know, we need some more time. Yes, maybe we, in Egypt, they've managed to bring down the Mubarak government. They have removed the head of the government. But the problem is the entire government, I mean, those people who are behind the stages, they've managed to keep what we used to call the deeply rooted country of Mubarak. You know, we have, like, the people of Mubarak in every, like, ministry, in every administrative section, in every, like, educational system. They were already there, you know. And even Morsi, when he tried to end up the corruption and the loss of money, everything that was there, he didn't succeed because those people, like, they have put lots of obstacles against him. And it was very clear for everyone who was following Egypt, you know. This guy won the election with his party, but lots of obstacles, or let's say many sticks have been placed within his wheel. That's the reason he did not work properly. You know, from day one, okay, of his ruling time, you know, he was attacked here and there, and they said that he's a weak man, he's a blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, things are clear now, and if you're looking at Egypt now, the case is getting worse. The case is getting worse. The economy is deteriorating, you know, and the stock market is losing in Egypt. There's no tourism in Egypt. You know, Egyptians are losing now. I think they did not realize their mistake by all means.
The oil and gas discoveries off the coast of Gaza, is Gaza going to be able to benefit from those or not?
Well, not at all, never, you know, until we have a real peace process with Israel, which would never come in my own humble personal view, you know.
Is that one reason why Israel will not allow or is against Gaza becoming a sovereign country? Is that the problem?
Well, I've been into the territorial woods of Gaza once or twice in my life in 2008 when the boats came to break the siege, and I've seen what happened my eyes, you know. We've seen this place where there is some gas there. I believe, as some reports said, you know, Israelis are stealing it. They have the mechanism, they have the machines. No one can see what they are doing in the high seas, as they say, you know. Right. I'm sure they already stole the gas that we have, or maybe there is something left. You know, Israel, they were smart, and they have the high tech, they have the equipment, and they can do and dig whatever they want in the high seas. People of Gaza, they cannot see more than 2 miles away from the sea. But we have these fields of gas and oil. It's back like maybe 7 miles within the high seas. We didn't know what is happening. We didn't have, like, the airplane or the drones to take footage of what the Israelis are doing. We didn't know. And at the end of the day, there were some agreements, you know, through British Gas and other companies about this. These agreements did not see the light.
Right. Then Gaza, since it's an odd country, it can perfect some of those oil and gas interests as in its existing entity. And what actually is Gaza? What is the governing entity now of Gaza?
Well, Gaza is the most complicated place in the whole planet, let me put it for you.
Yeah, okay. Well, that is complicated, isn't it?
Okay, I was born and I lived all my life in Gaza, and it's just this small strip of land, 43 square kilometers, from the north to the sea, it's less than nearly 5 kilometers, you know. You cannot, you know, like I come in London here, you spend like hours and hours, it's moving from one place to another in London. In Gaza Strip, you finish the 43 square kilometers in just less than half an hour, you know.
So right.
Gaza, you know, we don't have resources. The only resources that we have is the human resources. We have 1.8 million now, you know. We don't have resources. We don't have oil. We don't have a trade. We don't have anything. We are relying only on aid coming from outside. We do not have much of productivity. And, you know, most of the employees, like Hamas government has its own employees, like around 40,000, 50,000. And the Palestinian Authority have another, like, 100,000 employees in Gaza. And those people, they're getting their salaries through Hamas. And Hamas gets its salaries from outside. And the Palestinian Authority is ironically giving its funding from America, which is a treason for many Palestinians. That was the price of Oslo at the end of the day, you know. They wanted to give Palestinians money just to stay silent, forget about the state, and just getting money. You know, if there's not money, if there's not good economy, you know, the Palestinian and those who are allied with the Palestinian Authority would rebel, you know. But the Americans are smart. That's what I call it, a political financed, let's say, power. And that it was what is happening with the Palestinian Authority. I think it's a message for us Palestinians to defect from the American control, you know, by refusing. Although we will have trouble, but we have to refuse this conditional money that's coming from America and Europe so we could have independence in our national decision.
Okay. There have been some initiatives in the IT, Internet technology area. Are you aware of those? And could that possibly be some kind of business that could be generated from within Gaza?
Like what kind of
Internet technology, writing of software, creating of Internet services, et cetera. Could that be possibly something that – I know Palestinians are highly educated. Is that right?
Highly educated.
Highly educated.
It is highly or hardly. You know, your Texas accent is quite difficult for me.
No, highly, very, very educated.
Yeah, that's right, not hardly, because you sounded like hardly.
No, the Palestinians are well-educated people, as far as I know. I think they have a very good education system. So that would lend itself to getting into an IT market of some kind and creating companies within...
I could.
Yeah.
The only investment for us is human resources. We have 1.8 million.
Right.
We have lots of youth who are very educated in technology and industry and economy and in every kind of domain. But we didn't have the chance. You know, we are being besieged from Israel, and now we are being besieged and blocked from Egypt. And we have nothing but the sky. We have only our God to look and to supplicate for, really.
Right. That's no good, Sammy. I sympathize with your people. I really do.
Well, you know, like I lived my life there, and I know how it looks like, and it's very hard life. And I remember, you know, I'm looking from outside. It's different for me, and I used to live it. I used to experience the hardships that the people are experiencing these days.
Yeah.
And it's back like the old days, you know. The last week was similar to 2008 November, just 1 month before the cut did, you know. That's terrible, really. And I think it's going to go worse and worse. And if any attack in Syria happened, the people of Gaza might be affected. And if there was a panic atmosphere in Gaza yesterday, you know, when the American committee in the American Senate voted or gave a consent for Obama to attack Syria, we had some kind of panic in Gaza because we might be affected, you know, if any rocket would hit a Dimona nuclear planet in the Negev desert, which is a few kilometers away from Gaza, we would be affected, and Gaza might be polluted forever, contaminated with this nuclear radiation.
John Kerry has made some statements that there's a peace initiative underway. What do you say about that? What would you be your comments between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
Well, I always have a very pessimistic view for peace in the Middle East. It's a negative, like a view I always hold regarding the Middle East, because I believe Israelis didn't want peace. You know, Israelis want a peace that is miserable and especially tailored for them. You know, You know, they didn't want to give the Palestinians a state. They didn't want to give the Palestinians the borders. They didn't want to give the Palestinians sovereignty. They didn't want to give the Palestinians Jerusalem. And at the end of the day, they want to give Palestinian peace. That's a very ironic, you know, kind of mechanism by the Israelis. They want peace, but they can't offer any concession. You know, they are the occupier. They are the ones who have the land, the power, and the control in the region. No one can do peace but the Israelis. You know, the Palestinians already, they have suffered enough over the past 65 years, you know, since the Nakba, the catastrophe in 1948. We've been displaced worldwide, and yet the Israelis do not even want to recognize our pain and our displacement in diaspora. They want us to give us the most sacred right, which is the right to return, before even we talk about peace. I think peace is not visible with Israel at this moment, and I don't know when it will be.
Right. The Fatah, what is the relationship between Hamas and Fatah right now? Is there any kind
of... Well, it's tense, really. You know, there's a tense relation between Fatah and Hamas. You know, there's a national division that happened in 2007. Okay, you know, what happened between Hamas and Fatah, because Fatah did not really agree on the results of the elections. You know, they wanted to take Hamas into their boat and ask Hamas to recognize Israel, you know, on the basis that Israel would give them nothing, you know, like what happened with Fatah and Arafat back in the days, you know. But Hamas learned from the mistake of Fatah, and they did not want to recognize Israel, because at the end of the day, if they will recognize Israel, they would not be going to give a state. They would not be going to give anything from the Israeli. And that's the case with the Palestinian Authority and Fatah. They've been negotiating with Israel for nothing. The Israelis have offered them nothing, really. And that's the case. Now, you know, the relation between the two parties are tense, and Fatah is trying to establish a new movement. It's called Tamarud, which is rebel, the one it was in Egypt that managed to bring down Morsi. They're trying to do the same move against Hamas in Gaza. But Hamas, I think, is going to be difficult. It's not going to be like Egypt, because Hamas in Gaza is a militarized movement, not like the peaceful movement in Egypt, not like the Muslim Brotherhood. It's totally different. We are in a state of war with Israel, and the situation is different from Egypt.
Right. When a person lives in Gaza, but he can go across the border into Israel, is it very difficult to even cross the border at the checkpoints and go to a job that you might have? Tell me about that.
How
difficult is that?
It's more than complicated. Believe it or not, I'm 28 years. I moved from Gaza like 3 years ago. I never managed to get into Israel, from Gaza into Israel, to visit Jerusalem or to see what it is Israel like, or the old occupied Palestine. There's little checkpoints, and no one can get inside Israel from Gaza. It's a prohibited, because we are considered by Israel as a security threat. Every individual in Gaza is a security threat for Israel, even if they are kids or children aged a few months or even a few days. Israelis look at us as a threat. Okay, a long-term threat, you know, so we cannot move through into Israel and even into the West Bank. As you know, the West Bank and Gaza are supposed to be one country. Imagine that you are living in Texas, and in the same time you want another American state neighboring to Texas, but you can't, because there is some kind of Russian checkpoint in the way. You know, that's the case there. You know, we have a state, let's say, like sort of a Palestinian state. I don't call it a state. It's still not a state, really. It's two parts of a nation torn apart. We cannot see each other. I don't know what is the West Bank like. Never been to Jerusalem, to Ramallah, to Bethlehem, and all these places. I only watch it in the TV like you, although I am away maybe a few kilos, like dozens of kilometers away from these cities, but I've never been there.
Right. As far as the seaside of Gaza, is there any kind of fishing industry at all?
Well, by the Oslo Agreement signed in 1993 and 1994, We're supposed to go to fish within 20 miles in the sea, but Israel has been blockading us. So the fishermen cannot go more than 2 or 3 kilometers. Otherwise, they'd be shot dead or shot injured, or they would be taken and imprisoned by the Israelis. And this happened over the past 20 years, you know, since Oslo Accord was signed, you know. And also the sea is not a normal sea. We have a port, yes, a seaport. We got it ready, but we cannot have like a ferry to take like passengers from Gaza into Cyprus or the Mediterranean, because we are being circulated by the Israeli Navy, and no ships or boat can leave Gaza, and anyone would try to do it, they would be shot dead. You know, no one can leave. It's a prison. When I'm telling you Gaza is the biggest prison in the world, it's not part of my propaganda or a kind of a propaganda that I want to like tell your listener. It's the truth. You know, we don't have an airport. The only unsold airport we had in 2001, it only operated for 1 year, and it costed millions and millions, hundreds of million dollars. And the Israelis have destroyed it with the American-made F-16, okay? And the other terminal we have is with Egypt, which is closed now, and the other terminal, border terminal, with Israel, which is closed, and the sea is blocked. So we are really living in a prison.
Yeah. Well, my gosh, it's terrible. When was it that that the Israelis went into Gaza with that attack? What year was that? About 3 years ago or so.
Well, yeah, the major attack was called Qasr, as you know, in 2008, December 2009, January lasted 43 days. You know, it's called Qasr. They have killed over 1,400 people, mostly children. They have destroyed over 500 schools, mosques, the infrastructure. It was really a full-scale war. And also they've done the same in 2012 in November. For 7 days, they have launched another war where they have killed around 300 people.
My gosh. Were they also tearing up orchards and things like that with tanks and things, or what?
They did not come through the tanks. They only used the American F-16. They've used the American F-16s, and they really caused lots of damage for the people.
How about the violation of international accords with the use of phosphor type of weapons against civilian populations? Was that done?
Well, they always use violate international law. They've used the phosphorus, they use the depleted uranium. And at the end of the day, you know, the Gorbachev report spoke clearly about this. But, you know, at the end of the day, Obama and the Americans, they have the veto really in the Security Council. That's the issue. Israel can't get away with anything to do. That's the problem.
Yeah, that seems to, or that is absolutely the problem. I've had several people, General Peled, are you familiar with his name in Israeli history? He was one of the founders of the Israeli state. He's a general there in the army. Well, his son has been, you know, Peled, P-E-L-E-D, General Peled.
I can't comment on this, really.
Well, anyway, his son has been on my program a few months ago, and he said that his sister documented and wrote a book about the bias of the Israeli school districts or schools against the Palestinians, that they actually were indoctrinating in their schools. Sammy, are you there? We just lost Sammy Habib in London, and Mike, our engineer, can you try to get him back on? It was just cut off. He just totally dropped out. We were live from London. But anyway, we're gonna play a clip here. We've got a clip. Yeah, I'll get the clip set up on Bernard Lewis there, Mike, okay? So we've got a clip. Bernard Lewis is talking about the history of Islam and so forth, and he sort of brings it up to current times and equates it with 9/11. But listen very carefully to this clip, because he's promulgating and he's establishing all this history and so forth on the fact that 9/11 was a legitimate attack by jihadists, Islam jihadists, Osama bin Laden and others, on the New York towers. So if you listen very carefully, then you'll begin to see where they're coming from in some of these mechanizations and mind warp and mind control types of dynamics here. Go ahead, listen to this very carefully.
Bernard Lewis is widely recognized as one of the West's leading authorities on the Middle East. In the wake of September 11th, the Princeton historian's views are said to have had a strong influence on George Bush and his foreign policy. His latest book is called The Crisis of Islam, Holy War and Unholy Terror. Now, in explaining terrorism against the West, you have said, and I quote here, they hate us because they resent us. Your new book, The Crisis of Islam, looks at the historic roots of Islamic resentment towards the West. What are they? What are the big principal things that cause the roots of that resentment and Muslim rage?
Well, there are several aspects to it. One, take the larger general civilizational aspect. For the first 1,000 years, of the 14 centuries of Islamic history, Islam was always advancing somewhere. It had its defeats, its setbacks, but these were more than compensated by other advances. As late as the 17th century, there were still Turkish pashas ruling in Budapest and Belgrade, mm-hmm. Turkish armies besieging Vienna, and Barbary corsairs raiding the coasts of England and Ireland. So that it was still an advancing society, despite, as I said, some setbacks at the remote extremities like Spain and Portugal. From that point onwards, everything seemed to go wrong. They lost battle after battle, province after province, and found themselves outpaced and outperformed by the West, not only in the battlefield, but in the marketplace, in the schoolroom, and every other area. In our time, they have become acutely aware of this. Thanks to modern communications and modern media, there is now a sense of humiliation and what they see, the infidel world triumphing over the true believers, which has become much more powerful than at any time in the past. Now, this is reinforced by the feeling that now it is their turn and that they are again victorious. The most important single factor in that, I think, was the defeat of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. We tend to think of this as a victory of the West in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how they see it. They see it as a victory of Islam through the long, bitter struggle in Afghanistan, which ended with the retreat and defeat of the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. And that, after that, the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, as they see it, they had tackled the larger, more dangerous, more vicious of the two superpowers of the infidel world. Now it was time to deal with the other one, and this, they thought, would be comparatively easy. As they see it, the Americans are soft and pampered. One finds this refrain again and again in their writings.
Yeah, it's hard for us to understand the contempt, especially the fundamentalists have
this,
for the weakness.
As they see it, the Americans have become soft and pampered. One reads this again and again, hit them and they will run. And then they repeat the same litany. Vietnam, the Marines in Beirut, Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened in Somalia? As we in the West see it, this was a well-intentioned attempt to bring help to a country in civil war and misery when the intended beneficiaries proved murderously ungrateful. They thought, well, to hell with that, we're getting out. As they see it, this was an attempt to establish American imperial domination in Afghanistan and was defeated by the heroic struggle of the Somali Muslims. Now, why anyone in his right mind would, in America, would want to accept responsibility for Somalia in addition to all the others passes understanding. But that is how they see it. They see this as a victory of the Islamic struggle against American imperialism. Then come the 90s, when one attack after another is made on American institutions or barracks or individuals, none of which occasions any kind of response that is serious. You get angry words and misdirected missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all. this strengthens the impression. And again, this is not just my reading of it. This is what they say quite explicitly. They have gone soft, pampered, hit them and they'll run. This is the background of what happened on 9/11.
This is George Butler back. I hope you listened to that clip of Bernard Lewis talking about Islam and sort of taking it over the ages to where it had, you know, successes centuries ago, and then actually it's declining in scope and so forth. And then they did all of these terrorist acts. We didn't do anything, and then all of a sudden they did this 9/11, is what he's saying. But the thing is that Bernard Lewis in 1979 put together the Bernard Lewis plan. And that plan basically had to do with the balkanization of the Arab states. The Arab states were beginning to come together and become organized with the Arab League and so forth. And they were beginning to build armies in the Middle East. That coupled with their ability to finance those armies with their oil revenues began to present quite a problem for the state of Israel. And Bernard Lewis is loved and honored and very well respected by the Israelis. Wherever he speaks at a Jewish or Zionist type of meeting, the round of applause is very, very sharp and very loud and very long. So Bernard Lewis came up with this idea that, hey, the way to win and to subdue and suppress this Islam, you know, surrounding enemy was to balkanize them. So that's basically what you're seeing today in the Middle East. We're seeing a balkanization occur of the Arab states. And what's happening is they're going in. Whoever's going in, there is some grassroots here also that's being played like it was in Egypt. But basically, there's two warring sides. Let's take this conflict in Syria today. There are several people over the last 2 years that have had experience in Syria, and they said that there were provocateurs that were in there, and they'd go on the government side and fire against civilians, and they'd go on the civilian side and start picking off or firing and shooting soldiers. So we believe, and I believe, that the Syrian conflict was started by Western powers, be Israel, United States, and others, France, UK. These are some of the players today. When you're seeing the players, so to speak, today, you're seeing a falling off on this Syrian thing. We have a Congress today that is very, very, up in the air yet. There are some reports that are saying that on this war bill that's being put forward by Obama to go in, and he's got the resources there already in place, to go into Syria and retake it and so forth and and regime change and bring democracy and everything else to the region or to the country. But he's trying to get the Congress of the United States to sign off. The Senate has already put forward an out of committee, in violation of their own senatorial rules, a quick approval, you know, a bill, so forth. And the Senate is bought and paid for. There's only 100 of them. By the big financial and international interest. So it's not that hard and difficult to get the senators to sign off on things very quickly. You're only dealing with 100 senators. And like I said, that most senators are bought and paid for in Congress by these international financial interests. Now, Rand Paul and others have voted no in this committee. But they're a minority. I think it passed 10-7, and there was a one voted president, one senator voted present, I believe. But if you'll get back to this clip of this Bernard Lewis, he's painting a picture and assuming in this, and this clip ends with 9/11, that 9/11 was absolutely a foreign attack against this country and carried out by these radical Islam jihadists that are waging a war against America and against the Christian people. Well, if you're inclined to look at 9/11 very closely, I think you're going to find a much different picture than Bernard Lewis is putting forward. And what you're going to find is that it's very difficult to find plane parts on the Pentagon attack. There are none. that they're asking us, the so-called authorities are asking us, to believe that that plane went through a 20-foot diameter hole and just disintegrated. Are you kidding me? Not going to believe that. Then several of my friends over the years have asked me, well, what happened to the plane? Well, I can't tell you what happened to the plane, but I can tell you for sure that a 757 with two 10-foot engines made of titanium and a very large plane the parts of it, after it had crashed in the Pentagon, would not all of a sudden vaporize or disappear through a 20-foot hole. So they're asking, and they're asking the public to believe those kinds of things, but they're not true. So what is Bernard Lewis really coming from? He's 97 years old, professor, quite esteemed professor in Princeton, and he's putting forward these ideas. Well, he's definitely pushing the Israeli line, and that line says that these terrorists came in and attacked New York City. Well, who's to gain from that? Everyone that continues to put the lie out, and I call it a 9/11 myth, but it's a lie. There were no foreign terrorists that came in and attacked New York City. That was put together. It was a black ops operation. It was a deep operation with very few people having full knowledge of the attack and how the plan was to unfold. Our people out here, our American people, I had recently an experience up in the Hill Country, and there are just not enough people that are awake to what's really going on. But if you get back to that Pentagon, the photographic evidence around the Pentagon does not prove that that plane crashed into the Pentagon. You cannot find enough evidence of debris. The engines themselves are made of titanium. There's a ceramic that is edging, the edges around the fins, the outer, you know, turbine fins that are made of a ceramic that takes 7,500 degrees to even melt those. Titanium takes 5,000 degrees. There would have been seats and bodies all over the front lawn, which we won't find, and we don't find in the examination of photographs of the Pentagon crash. So that's one thing. Another thing is that we're being set up, folks, and to take the big fall. They keep bringing up 9/11. It's a dynamic thing, much like the Pearl Harbor effect, but it's a greater, it's a more insidious and a more evil idea and influence than any Pearl Harbor, because it's the big lie. The big lie, American public, they're not awake yet. They're going for the big lie. And you parade the big lie before them, and you've got them. You've got them under control. And that control, basically, is being used to take this country into a national police state. And there might be martial law in the future or whatever. It's not something pleasant to think about or even contemplate. But I'm here trying to hold the line and trying to awaken the public. This Bernard Lewis is no good for America. He's a con artist. He's just putting out information to further the international financiers' hold over America. So look at some of his other videos on YouTube, and you'll begin to see what I'm talking about. I want to thank you for listening to us tonight. We had Sammy dropped off. We weren't able to get him back up. But thank you very much for listening, and we hope that you got something out of that Bernard Lewis clip. And don't believe that man. He is an expert to a degree, but he's using it to control America and to use us for the international interests that are just about ready to take over this country. So what we must do is we must awaken and resist those kinds of ideas and expose those kinds of propagandists. And Bernard Lewis is a supreme propagandist, I must say, with a very shrewd and a very sharp argument. Thank you for listening, and good night.